Call the meeting to order of the House Commerce Committee. We do have a quorum. We have an action-packed agenda, so we're going to jump right in. Our first item is approval of the minutes from February 21st, 2024. Representative Tabke, do you want to make a motion? Representative Tabke moves to approve the minutes from February 21st, 2024. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes from February 21st, 2024 are approved. Our first item on our agenda today is House File 3539. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Edelson. I will move House File 3539 be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Edelson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3539 takes steps to make compressed aerosol dusters like this one right here more difficult to obtain in retail stores in Minnesota. What appears to be a harmless product has in recent years become the cause of many deaths, harm, and addiction to Minnesotans. This is due to the toxic nature of ingesting a chemical called DFE. It's a liquefied gas. People ingest these products to get high by spraying them in their mouth or in their nose. DFE causes intoxication or death. This is not only an increasing problem in Minnesota, but it's across the United States. I sent members a copy of the U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission's report on aerosol dusters. It should be in your packet or a link to it. This is not only, in this report you will also find the data from NICE, which is the National Electronic Injury Surveillance System. In the timeline between 2006 and 2020, the review numbers showed that 70% of the incident victims were male. There were 1,126 deaths that resulted from this. The youngest death was a child that was 13 years old, and the oldest was a 70-year-old man. 37 deaths were in Minnesota. The highest usage was between the ages of 18 to 54, and there were 25,300 ER visits due to injuries. This is not a small occurrence. According to the data published in the 2019 SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Service Administration estimated that 2.9 million lifetime uses of these computer cleaners or air dusters is occurring now. The bill before you seeks to start to regulate this product that is being abused due to the chemical, again, called DFE. And so what the bill before you does is it mandates that these items right here be placed behind the counter or in a locked case in retail facilities. It requires that you are only able to sell three per day. It requires that all said products are sold it will be half of the can would be covered with a warning. And I have worked with physicians and Hennepin Health to work on what that language would look like. And we have a testifier here today. So with that, Mr. Chair, we have some impacted families, one who has lost their son, Tommy, another family who their child is actively struggling with addiction with these products. And so I ask members to be very respectful, as always, as you are. But this has been a really hard time for families in the state of Minnesota, and I'd love to call our testifiers, please.
Thank you, Representative Edelson. The first testifier we have on the list is Samantha Lee, the director of the Hennepin County Poison Control. You just come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Samantha Lee. I'm the director of the Minnesota Poison Control System, and I'm a pharmacist and a clinical toxicologist. For the past 5 years, our Poison Center has managed close to 100 cases related to air duster exposure in Minnesota. However, I must stress that this number is likely underestimation since calling the Poison Center is voluntary. Most of these cases involve individuals in their 20s and 30s, highlighting the vulnerability of a demographic often unaware of the lethal risks associated with inhaling abuse. A 2023 published study by our Poison Center colleagues in Ohio reviewed the National Inhalant Misuse Report to the National Poison Data System from 2001 to 2021. It revealed that U.S. Poison Centers managed over 26,000 inhalant misuses over the two decades, with just over half of these composing of Freon and other propellants, including DFE-containing air dusters. 41% were associated with a serious medical outcome, and over a quarter were admitted to healthcare facilities. DFE containing air dusters are widely available at low cost and usually not considered a poison or dangerous by the public. But inhalant abuse creates an immediate high that can last for minutes to a couple of hours. And the chemicals within the air dusters can take the place of oxygen in the blood and the brain, leading to effects such as drunk and dazed appearance, unsteady gait, or loss of consciousness. The biggest concern is that it can cause sudden sniffing death syndrome and produce irregular heart rhythms that may lead to cardiac arrest and death. The provisions outlined in this bill are essential safeguards against further harm through sale restrictions and prominent health warnings. I commend the efforts of this committee to prioritize public safety and address the urgent need for legislative action in combating inhalant misuse. Thank you for your time and attention to this critical issue.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Katie O'Mara. You want to come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ready? And take your time.
My name is Katie O'Mara. I'm the mom of Tommy Byers, my only child. On November 1st, 2022, Tommy's life was stolen by difluoroethane, the poison in computer duster. Representative Edelson has been helping me through this, searching for how we can stop our loved ones from dying. My child did die. It could be your child or anyone's child that's the next victim. Our expectation today is that we find a way to protect our kids from dying from this poison. Tommy's dad and I had no idea what this huffing was. We'd never heard of it. We didn't know the signs. We didn't even know it existed. No one deserves to die like this. No parent deserves to lose a beloved child to a cheap hardware store can of poison. In a span of 3 weeks, Tommy's free will was gone. He was no longer making decisions for himself. The psychoactive properties of the poison had taken over. How can we stop this from becoming a giant epidemic, from infiltrating our schools? For starters, let's shine a great big light on this stuff. Let's be brave and talk about it. No more hiding, no more lying, no more shame, no more fear. My son was an accomplished professional man, charismatic and deeply committed to his large group of colleagues and dear, dear friends and family. I can't save Tommy now, but I can help save other people's children. We must pass this law. Tommy's word was Tommy's truth. When Tommy loved you, he loved you forever. I know my son is here with us now. I love you, baby.
Thank you very much for sharing your story. I know it was very difficult.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Colonel Matt Langer from the State Patrol. Colonel Langer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So there is a traffic safety component to this bill, that being if we can keep dust off and similar products outside the hands of people using it inappropriately, there is an opportunity to save lives on the highway. That's not as common as other drugs or substances that people can abuse, but this is one that people do abuse, and I can remember at least one fatal crash that killed a father and young son that was dust off related years ago. So if we can keep this out of the hands of people using it for inappropriate purposes and safeguard that, I think it's a good thing for our state, including traffic safety.
Thank you, Colonel Langer. We'll now move to members of the public to testify. We did have one member of the public sign up in advance, Bruce Newstead from the retailers. Mr. Newstead.
Mr. Chair, good afternoon, members of the committee. I'm Bruce Newstead with the Minnesota Retailers Association. I work with retailers across the state. Some of them are your smallest Main Street brands up to your more large national no brands. I appreciate the opportunity to talk today about Representative Ellison's bill today. We've had a great conversation with Representative Ellison. I think you've heard some of the problems associated with the product. We continue to talk to Representative Ellison about what behind the counter might look like and looking at what an effective date might look like to make sure there's a reasonable opportunity for folks to get this right from a retail perspective. Should the legislature decide that this is an issue, we'll certainly work hard to make sure that age 21 provision is in place. So we look forward to continuing to work with Representative Ellison on this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Newstead. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Edelson. I just have a couple of quick questions. One, I'm wondering, it says specifically, it makes sense that this would be behind the counter, offer additional protection that way. The provision that would not allow a retailer from selling more than three cans in a single transaction, and I apologize, I didn't get all the way to the end of the bill. Are there any exemptions? I mean, I'm thinking of situations where there could be, I guess maybe it doesn't apply to distributors. Like, how does this apply? I'm just thinking of somebody who runs a computer repair shop who maybe has a retailer that they use to purchase these products. Like, how would it affect things like that?
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. You'll see that we're only regulating essentially retail storefronts for the most part, and we're not going to be doing that in bulk because a lot of corporations are using that, but that's not where we're seeing the problem. Some stores where they're actually seeing this happen often is they've already put it behind the counter. People are using these products literally within the store. So we're limiting it to three because there is oftentimes, if you look at some of the data, if you look at the report that you have within, sometimes you'll see 12 cans in someone's car when they passed, or up to 40 bottles in their apartment. We're trying to get at the issue. So what we know about retail or other regulation of products that are causing public harm and a public health issue is that putting them behind or limiting sales actually does improve the situation to some extent. But the computer supplier will be able to get theirs probably in bulk. They're probably not going to buy it at a retailer. So I guess in that instance, where the public health situation would be that they would buy it in via mass online through their manufacturer or right through the distributor.
And I do note you have an exemption on lines 2.4 and 2.5 mm-hmm. for exactly those transactions you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. Representative New Brindley?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, I was thinking specifically of a small mom-and-pop computer repair shop who this could be problematic for, who wouldn't be purchasing massive, you know, bulk quantities from a distributor online. I'm just thinking of those. My other question is, where did you come up with the specific labeling language? There is a lot going on here with the labeling. Where did you come up with these specific labeling requirements? This is pretty unique, I think, and unusual from what I've seen in the past.
Representative Edelson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think if a small computer person needed to have, it was a small shop, I don't know that they're going to need more than three cans of this right here in one day. So I guess what I would say is I consulted with Hennepin Health and a group of physicians on the language on the bottle. It is actually, a lot of it is contained within the consumer report that I provided. But I don't know if we could call up the testifier from Hennepin Health. Again, the pharmacist could probably speak to where the language came from. I believe it was from several other states.
Ms. Lee, are you able to step forward and provide a little more information?
Mr. Chair, Representative. The labeling design, we reach out to several of our colleagues in the poison center world to kind of give their ideas on what sort of things would be helpful to the public. A lot of it is trying to make it more visual and easy for users when they're glancing at the bottle to see versus having tiny writings that you really have to read through it to recognize the danger that's behind the product if it's being misused.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just really wanted to thank you, Representative Edelson, and your testifier for this bill. I did not know about this stuff. So right now, they have done something really important, and you have, just by bringing this to the public. So I just wanted to really start there. And this is just really horrifying that this is happening. And it seems like it sure ought to be preventable in many cases. So just even from the point of view of knowledge, which is what the labeling is about, of course. I just really wanted to ask if And maybe you don't have this information right here, but this seems like something that, first of all, is there some other product that could be, some other propellant that could be used that's less harmful? And is there any like movement at the federal level to actually ban this stuff? Or this just seems like it's such a huge issue, and it just seems like it ought to be fixable.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair, for your question. These products are about $10 per bottle. There are other ways to clean that don't can provide chemicals in it, the DFE, so there are other options. There are also electronic options where you could just, you know, use a powered electronic where you can recharge it, and there's no chemical at all. So really, I mean, I really tried to take a pragmatic approach on this bill, that we wouldn't ban it because there is work being done at the federal level right now trying to address this issue. And there, I told you, there was thousands, more than 23,000 families that we know of that have been impacted by this. And they're really advocating on the federal level on this issue.
Representative Dodson.
Thank you, Chair. Number one, I have to say it's very unfortunate to hear about your family members. It's tragic. I'm so sorry to hear that. But more of a question than anything else is, educate me a little bit. Is this similar to what they call huffing, where it's actually aerosol cans where you see even, I've been at grocery stores where you see Cool Whip, and there's cans of Cool Whip. Is it a different product, or is there something different? And second part of that question would be, how do we manage this as far as age appropriation, as far as marketing and selling these products? Because that's a whole other issue when these products come for marketing and selling at the store as well.
Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a really good question, Representative. We made the bill for, we're putting it either behind the counter or behind a locked case, and that you have to be 21 or older to purchase it. So we're trying to limit access to these products. We limited it to three. With that, it's not the same as Cool Whip, right? Cool Whip doesn't have that DFE, that chemical compound in there that is automatically getting people high. And also, not only getting them high, but it results in oftentimes death. And so, it is not, so I'm passing around a can just so you have it. People are adding bitterants to it. That's been a national discussion, if bitterant is a way to make people stop. But there's a lot of arguments that show that that actually doesn't. People just get used to the bitterant. And so not actually as helpful as one would have thought. So I think there's a lot of discussions nationally. I think this is a good beginning bill to start the process of trying to make a public awareness on this and protecting people.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Elson. Any closing comments?
I just thank committee members for your time today. I also included the poison control data right here. It's 94 count in the last 5 years that have impacted, but I would just say these numbers are low. For Minnesota, not everybody's calling poison control. Not everybody is gathering that data. We don't have it. And if you look, the numbers keep increasing. So I ask members for your support. Thank you.
All right. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3539 be re-referred to the Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 3539 is recommended be re-referred to the Public Safety, Policy, and Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Ellison. Thank you for coming here today and sharing your story again. All right. The next bill on our agenda today is House File 3652 by Representative Olson. I will move House File 3652 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Olson, when you're ready, it's your bill.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and committee members. So House File 3652 was brought to me by a constituent. And he is not able to be here today because he's a teacher at Hermantown Public Schools, and I think they may be streaming part of this, so getting a little lesson in civics and a chance to hear a bill. And so this was brought to me by a constituent, as I mentioned, and what it is a disclosure for the electronic ordering devices. So if you've been anywhere ordering screens like Texas Roadhouse in Duluth, which is the impetus for this bill, which I'll share a little bit about, where you can order, but they also have games and other things. And so this is a requirement to do a disclosure to make sure that if a child is playing with the device that they're not charged for something. Like if you go into your phone, like my daughter will often want to be on my phone, go to the apps and try to download something, but it'll require me to verify the purchase. So a similar disclosure for the ordering devices for the games and other things, it would incur a fee. And so in lieu of him being here, I hope it's okay. There is written testimony in your packet, but I actually just like to read it to put a little context into being he couldn't be here. So I will verbalize his testimony. So, dear state legislators, my name is Andrew Olson and I live in Duluth. About a year ago, I took my family to Texas Roadhouse in Duluth. This is a family favorite restaurant that we previously went to about 7 to 10 times a year. At our last visit there, there was a Ziosk brand tablet on the table. The waitress encouraged us to use the device for adding items on our order or paying the final bill. The ease was welcomed until we were given our bill. There was a $1.99 charge added on the bill. I asked our waitress what the extra $1.99 charge was for, and she explained that it was for using the device. Upon further questioning, it turned out that the charge was for my son clicking on a game app. My son Jack was in second grade at the time, and for a brief moment, he was looking at the tablet on the table. He explained that when he saw the game, he touched the app. The device then opened a confirmation screen. He didn't understand what it meant. I then looked at the device. The issue I found was the screen that followed was very confusing and misleading. The writing was smaller to cancel the purchase and less illuminated. The information provided was unclear, and to a young child, he didn't know what to do. He did not play any games on the device and had it for less than a minute. The way that it was set up, the cancel icon is a shade lighter, and the way it is written implies that a purchase has already been made. The confirmation screen offered two options. The first was let's play, and the second was to cancel the $1.99 purchase. The way it was written, the charge had already been made just for clicking on the game icon. Even the way the two options were presented was not clear, especially to a young child. When I asked for a manager while we were leaving, she stated that this charge had been questioned over 20 times that day, and for most people, the establishment refunded the money. If 20 people a day were bringing this up, that would mean that many more didn't notice the charge on the bill. Some customers may have assumed that this $1.99 charge at the end of the bill was just another extra charge being added onto bills after service has been rendered. That has become a common practice and deceptive in its own way. I told the manager to keep the $1.99 as it would then remind me not to go back and patronize their restaurant. On our way home, my son asked if he did something wrong. That was what bothered me about this entire scenario. He didn't do anything wrong, in my opinion. I should have checked the device before he grabbed it, but this deceptive marketing practice shouldn't be legal. Parental consent should be required if there would be an extra charge for an item like this at a family restaurant. Imagine if Chuck E. Cheese allowed kids to play unlimited video games and then gave their parents a bill after the fact. It would be considered unethical. These devices are deceptive and unethical, which I explained to my son, and we used it as a lesson in how companies can sometimes take advantage of people. But I didn't like that it was done at an establishment we trusted. My son's guilt is why I'm not going back and why I wrote to the legislature for the first time in my life. The owner of Texas Roadhouse called me later after I spoke to the manager and said in the past week he personally refunded many people in the same situation. His response made me think of everyone who left and just paid the fee. It is wrong. It also made me think about the many people who had to complain and how other kids felt responsible. The owner then explained that the corporate side of Texas Roadhouse had made an agreement with Ziosk to add these devices. He also said that other restaurants were using them already. I was offered gift cards, but I refused. The situation left me disappointed that a restaurant encouraging the device's use and trying to cater families would have a device that works in this manner. Changing the way these menus are presented on the device would support parents and avoid more unnecessary charges. These devices are at many very popular restaurants now. The fees add up, and this company, Ziosk, is reaping the rewards. We have smartphones and iPads for kids to use. Most applications require parental consent before there is a charge. Being clear about these devices to customers should be a requirement for their use, but having some parental control before charging minors should also be a consideration. When looking at this online, there were many posts from upset customers going back for several years. On the Ziosk website, the company lists the information about how the device can increase money that restaurants are making, saying, in quote, "Let Ziosk be your ultimate revenue booster with on-screen promotions, engaging content, and fun games that not only entertain guests, but also drive incremental dollars." So thank you, and I hope you can help to end this practice of charging minor money without parental consent in a method such as this. So thank you, members, for letting me read that, being he couldn't be here. And so with that, I stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative Katisa Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Olson, for bringing this forward. I had a similar instance, actually, to your constituent. My father-in-law wanted to take us out for dinner when he was visiting once, and so we went to a beloved establishment that has never-ending breadsticks. Many of you may be familiar. And so in addition to the never-ending breadsticks, I have four children, four small children, and so like one device is not enough. We were there on a weeknight. We typically don't do phones or iPads or something to keep our kids entertained. It's sort of just a family expectation that they're able to sit there and enjoy their meal and talk to us and play amongst themselves. But this night we were, you know, conversing with my father-in-law, and there was one device on the table. The area was not busy at all. There was surrounding tables that also had assigned devices. And so at some point, I mean, I think that my kids each had their own individual little thing, and we didn't know anything that there was any fees or anything at the end of the meal. We did notice that there was, like, I think it was a $5 fee actually in this instance, and then the waiter said that for the other tables, like, the fee would have gone on those other tables' bills even though that somebody wasn't sitting there. And so he said, "This is okay, I'll just reset them, but, like, just so you know." And we're like, how would we be expected to know that? It was just kind of like, it's there, and it's maybe even we should, you know, have people request them if they want to play on such a device, because if it's there, we already know that screen time, I mean, the kids are going to definitely, like, jump onto some sort of electronic option. And so I really appreciate your constituent bringing this forward. It's so important that parents and families know that there's a cost to these things, and to have a little bit more framework makes a lot of sense.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Olson. I just wanted to comment on Representative Katisa Watoon's observation that maybe those devices should be delivered to the table at the request of the customer. In the marketplace that the restaurant that you mentioned, your constituent mentioned, I frequent that in my marketplace, and you can't get one of those devices without actually asking them, because they want to get your driver's license, and they want to know who may ultimately end up walking out of their establishment with one of those devices. So, and the challenge becomes some of the games on there are free, and some of the games aren't, because they continually have trivia-related contests and things, and that's one of the allures for my friends and I to go there, is we like to participate in that. But just for the record, I don't know if it's a company policy, but in the marketplace that I'm familiar with this, you do have to request the boxes to be able to get them at your table. They're not just there for that. So they are being able to manage it at a local level a little bit anyhow, for those who are wondering. And just because of your comment, I thought, oh, connect those two dots together here today.
Any closing comments, Representative Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. And I think there's probably multiple approaches to handling this situation, right? And there's also some work, you know, we could do around enforcement and other things. But I think the constituent had a really great idea and is really addressing, I think, a problem we all know is out there. And I really appreciate the committee's support of this bill.
Well, thank you, Representative Olson. And with that, the bill is laid over. The next item on our agenda today is House File 3777 from Representative O'Driscoll. And when you arrive at the front, Representative Driscoll, you may move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I move House File 3777 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a liquor omnibus bill should one be in the offing this session. And, Mr. Chair, I do have an amendment that I'd like to take to the bill to get it in the shape that I would like, and so I'd like to offer the A1 amendment.
Representative O'Driscoll offers the A1 amendment. Discussion to the amendment. Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion no. prevails, and A1 is adopted. Representative Driscoll, to your bill as amended. I registered the nay.
Mr. Chair, division? As many of you are aware, during the time of the pandemic, we lost a lot of workers in a lot of different career areas, including the hospitality industry. And I've been approached in the past during the pandemic with this idea, and it was included in an omnibus bill, but for differences between the Senate and the House and the time frame to get this bill, that omnibus bill underway, this particular provision hit the cutting floor. The provision allows for establishments, if they are so inclined, to be able to hire 17-year-olds to serve alcohol in to the tables when customers come in and order. A number of proprietors who I've spoken to have said we have persons who are 17 years of age or under who basically stand off to the side because they are not able to bring alcohol to the tables. They have to go get a manager or the owner or other person 18 and older to be able to deliver those alcoholic beverages to the table. Some of the concerns that people have cited on this would be they are underage, under the age of majority. However, the bill provides for a provision that is the same as in statute right now, that anyone who's going to be serving alcohol has to be trained. The license holder is responsible for the actions of their employees, and that that individual could choose as the owner to hire or not to hire persons who are 17 years of age or older. The part that I found most appealing about this is that most 17-year-olds may be sophomores or for sure juniors in high school, which would mean that they would be able to have a period of time in association with the restaurant, their junior year, their senior year, and then the year before they leave high school and go to college. And that provides stability and employment, predictability for the employer, as well as the employee who's going to be able to generate tips for money to be able to save for college. The amendment that we adopted today took out a two-year provision on this. And as I was thinking about it, I don't want people, if this becomes law, to be immediately non-compliant. So if you think about it, it says from the date of enactment in the original bill. So if we had this enacted and signed by the governor, say, on May 30th of this year, it would take us to May 30th of next year, 2025, and then it would expire on May 30th of 2026, just in time for all the resorts and the summertime activities who have done all their hiring and training to not be able to be qualified to have these folks. They may or may not be aware of that, and I do not want to have businesses inadvertently be involved in a liquor violation because of the way that the law was written. And so I trust the legislature, if there's a problem, we come back and fix this or modify the law, or quite frankly, if it's not working, to pull the provision from state law. So, Mr. Chair, I don't have any testifiers. We did have some previously, and so that is the extent of the bill.
Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move on to member discussion and questions to the bill. Representative Cleavorne.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative O'Driscoll, I can appreciate where the legislation is coming from and the need for additional service employees at different restaurants, especially with our resort area situation. However, one of the major concerns I have about this bill is that a 17-year-old is still a minor, and in many of our communities, I grew up in small town areas. So I understand how difficult it is for a 17-year-old to maybe say no to the parents of a friend or friends of parents. So when you're in a community like that, how do we ensure that this 17-year-old, I understand you say that they would be trained, but there's still an imbalance of power. How would this 17-year-old say no to the best friends of their parents or to their coach or to some other well-respected member of the community?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Cleavorne, that is an excellent question. I have been asked that question in the past on this bill. And I would submit to you that it's the same as if you are somebody who is 20, 19, 18, under the legal drinking age. Persons are going to pressure those individuals as well to do something illegal. In many of the places that I'm referring to that have brought this, they have management staff that watches and oversees the staff to look at these kinds of things. And it would be my estimation that there would be training about peer pressure or about pressure on this from the individuals who are coming to the table to try to push or to pressure you to serve alcohol. For those of you who are familiar with the alcohol enforcement in Minnesota, there are secret shoppers that go from the local law enforcement agencies, and that would be an excellent way for a law enforcement agency to be able to ask a question, you know, sending someone who's underage to see about being served, to test whether the training and the employment environment is actually enforcing the law. And if not, they can suffer severe penalties as a result of that. I've also wasn't part of your question, but it is on that same idea. What happens if you clear the table and there's alcohol? What about that 17-year-old? The 17-year-old can clear the table as a busser under age 18. If there's a will, there's a way to abuse the laws on alcohol to get those into the hands of minors. And that's where it is a conscious decision by the employing business to decide if they want to take on that additional responsibility and thus liability that's associated with it. It's not compulsory that they have to. It certainly gives them another option.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you. I'm not very much concerned about somebody finishing an empty half-consumed drink. I am more concerned about people leaving the establishment who may have been overserved, and I think it puts our 17-year-olds in a really bad situation. So I thank you for your answer, and that's my final question. Thank you.
Representative Fred.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll, for the bill. I have some similar concerns to Chair Cleburne. I was just looking up the age to serve laws around the state. I found a chart that the National Institute of Health has. It says the only states that go below 18 are Maine and Michigan, which have 17. Although I have seen some articles saying there's kind of a wave of laws around the state trying to lower the age, and one article said in Wisconsin there's a bill introduced to lower the age to serve to 14, which is a little alarming, I feel like. But I did find, kind of consistent with what Chair Cleburne was asking about, but then also it kind of raises another point. There's some information from the Economic Policy Institute that says serving alcohol puts underage workers at risk of sexual harassment and increases the likelihood that underage workers and customers will consume alcohol, and you kind of addressed the issue about the likelihood that they will consume it. I don't know, do you have any response just to the concern about the risk of sexual harassment or anything along those lines?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Feiberg. I don't have any comments. I don't have any information on that. That's from what I heard you say, it's speculation that it might happen. I don't know that they had any hard evidence that showed in states that do allow liquor to be served by 17-year-olds that there was data specifically on that, but it was more of a conjecture. I'm not going to enter into the grounds of what could be might happen. I don't know.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll. The question I have is, you know, 18 seems like there's some rationale, a minor. Below that is a minor. But if you go to 17, why not 16? I mean, why? What is so special about 17 versus, like, what's the rationale for that?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Kraft, the point that we're at 17 is it's introducing another group of workers that are already in the hospitality industry that have an understanding about taking orders, serving food, the rules that go along with public health and public safety in those environments. And so to be able to have them be a part of this, it seems like a logical group of people who you would look to bring them into that next level. And again, many restaurants, maybe not in your community, but across the state, are experiencing shortages, and they're trying to be able to get in and find a way to be able to survive and thrive. And we also know that with increasing retail tickets at places, fewer and fewer people are going out more often, or I should say less often, because of the increase in pricing, and it makes it more difficult for those businesses to be able to stay in business. Over this weekend, we just had a very large pizza establishment close in my community after 20 years because the cost of doing business has just gotten to be unbearable for them at that location.
President Kraft?
Yeah, one quick thought. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But can't a 16-year-old work in the same establishments?
Representative O'Driscoll.
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And just I just want to kind of make a quick statement about this, and because Representative Driscoll, your comment about the tips and that they can start to earn tips and save for college and so on, really, and the other discussion about potential sexual harassment really made me think about this. You know, there is a concern in a tip-based work environment, any worker is more vulnerable potentially to sexual harassment. And why is that? It's because by its very nature, getting tips is about pleasing the customer, not being unpleasant, trying to accommodate their requests and so on. And it really puts workers in a very difficult situation. So when you take that with younger people who are now serving alcohol to older people by definition, who and are also, of course, responsible as servers are for drawing the line on over-serving and making sure and carding people and so on, I think it's not a great situation. And like some of my colleagues here, I really don't favor that approach. So just thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Closing comments, Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I in my lifetime have met 17-year-olds and even 16-year-olds who I think are much more mature and knowing how to deal with issues that have come before them than people who are, well, might I even say older than age 21, and I'll just leave it at that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, the bill is laid over. The next bill on our agenda is House File 3857 from Representative Hollins. I will move House File 3857 be placed on the General Register. Representative Hollins, when you're settled, to your bill.
Thank you so much, Chair Stevenson, and thank you, committee members. I am here to present a pretty simple bill. It is technical changes to the catalytic converter bill that we passed last year. Folks might remember that there are new statutory requirements for scrap metal dealers and sellers regarding the purchase and acquisition of scrap metal, motor vehicles, and catalytic converters that went into effect on August 1st. And as a part of these new requirements, the BCA took a look at it and said there's a couple of inconsistencies and technical changes that needed to be made, and so I am bringing that bill here. And I am going to leave it to my testifier to talk about why those changes are necessary.
I believe your testifier is Scott Mueller. Mr. Mueller, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and committee. My name is Scott Mueller. I'm the Deputy Superintendent at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and I will make this really quick. The first provision is simply just moving language around within the statute that's already there, just for consistency's sake. And the second part of it is making an inconsistency a little bit more consistent, I guess. There's one portion of the statute that says that the records are going to be permanent. We would like to change that to be more consistent with a different part of the statute that says 3 years. 3 years seems very feasible and within the realm of investigation.
All right. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, member discussion and questions to the bill. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hollins. It looks like, so I've talked to some scrap metal folks, and from the initial read, it looks like, I mean, it's kind of a messy statute, and this is likely just cleaning up a piece of that. But as they are working through it, they just want to make sure that there aren't unintended consequences of it moving elsewhere. Will you just let me know, are you just willing to work with the scrap metal folks if they do find something that they think might be a conflict?
Representative Hollins.
Sure, of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I assumed that that would be your response, and I really appreciate that. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Closing comments, Representative Hollins.
Thank you so much for your time.
And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 3857 be placed on the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 3857 is recommended to be placed on the General Register. The next item on our agenda today is House File 3680 from Vice Chair Katiza Watoon. And whenever you are settled, you may move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 3680 to be referred to the General Register.
Vice Chair Katiza Watoon moves House File 3680 to be placed on the General Register, and you have an amendment, the A1 amendment. Do you want to move that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Members, I would like to move the A1 amendment. It is a technical amendment that was recommended by some of the advocates.
Representative Katisa, would you move out, the A1 amendment? Discussion to the amendment. Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the A1 is adopted. Representative Katisa Watoon, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 3680 is a simple bill that will close remaining loopholes after the work that we did last year to cap predatory lending rates. This proposal protects Minnesotans from harmful out-of-state lenders and supports Minnesota businesses because it requires that out-of-state lenders comply with the same lending regulations that are required for Minnesota-based lenders. This bill fixes a problem caused by the Depositor Institutions Deregulation and Monetary Control Act of 1980, or DIDMCA for short. The law passed in 1980 allows banks chartered in other states to charge Minnesota borrowers at the rate allowed in that bank's home state, even if it is higher than what would be allowed under Minnesota law. And of course, this impacts other states, but we're only talking about Minnesota here today. House File 3680 will allow Minnesota to opt out of DIDMCA's rate exportation provision, preventing out-of-state lenders from evading Minnesota's lending laws. Iowa and Puerto Rico opted out of this in the 1980s, and Colorado opted out of this just last year in response to predatory internet lending. There's no evidence that states that have opted out have been subject to reduced credit access or increased lending costs. The proposal requires that out-of-state banks lend at rates permitted under Minnesota law, putting them on equal footing with financial institutions here in Minnesota. Last year, the Commerce Omnibus included a provision that capped interest rates for short-term payday loans, which was a great first step in helping Minnesotans in need to find a non-predatory financial product. This bill finishes that work by closing the loophole that allows non-Minnesota-based lenders to import much higher rates than we currently allow Minnesota state chartered financial institutions. I do have a number of testifiers as well, Mr. Chair.
And the first testifier I have is Ann Leland from Exodus Lending. Just want to state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, my name is Ann Leland. I serve as the executive director of a statewide nonprofit called Exodus Lending. Thanks for having me back. We work with financially excluded Minnesotans to get people out of debt traps by refinancing high-cost predatory debt. Since we've opened our doors, we've reached more than 715 Minnesotans across 46 counties and refinanced more than 1,000 predatory loans and saved $2.2 million that otherwise would have been drained in interest and fees in our communities. In 2023 alone, this has become a growing issue, these rent-a-bank online loans. We refinanced 41 of these rent-a-bank loans that carried average interest rates of 188% because we get loan disclosures for every loan we refinance. Let me be clear, these are not short-term small-dollar loans that we're seeing. These are longer-term, higher-cost installment loans that are bigger, deeper, and harder to escape than the short-term payday loans we addressed last year. These loans, no Minnesotan should have to pay, I mean, I'm going to just use the most recent example, $6,000 on a $3,000 loan over the course of 7 months. Put simply, evasion of Minnesota state's usury laws by out-of-state lenders should not be permitted. We are here to level the playing field, support our Minnesota banks, credit unions, and we have a really rich history of community development nonprofits in Minnesota to reach this market. Beyond the numbers, more importantly, is the stories of the hardworking Minnesotans that are getting stuck and that we work with every day, that are getting stuck in these rent-a-bank loans. So I'm really honored to be joined by Christine Westbrook, a responsible Minnesota borrower who took out a loan from OppFi, a really common lender we see in Minnesota, at an unmanageable rate of 200%. She's here today to share her story. So I'll welcome Christine up.
Great. If you would just come forward, state your name for the record, and proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, my name is Christine Westbrook. Sorry, guys, I'm really nervous. But
take your time.
I'm a single parent of five kids, and I was going through some financial hardship while at work, actually. And a colleague was like, you should take out a payday loan through OppFi. And I Googled it, and it just drew me into the screen. Like, you can get the money today in 2 hours, direct deposit. And I'm like, okay, cool. Clicked it, got approved. and was making my like payments. It was coming out of biweekly out of my paychecks. And COVID happened. I ended up losing my job. And it kind of got put on the back burner because I lost my job. So it was like, whatever. But then once I got into home ownership, things on my credit started to resurface, and that was one of them. And I do currently have a financial counselor, and she was able to put me in tune with Exodus Lending. Exodus Lending was able to reach out to OppFi, come up with like an amount they were willing to settle the account. They paid that off, and now since doing that, it was like a light at the end of the tunnel for me because now I pay an affordable payment to Exodus Lending for paying off my OppFi loan on my behalf. So just at the time, I was just going through it financially. I didn't read the small fine print, but to me, it's unethical to have to pay back the amount on top of the amount I borrowed. I couldn't literally afford it after things resurfaced after me trying to go into my home ownership. So thank God for Exodus Lending because now I'm at a better place with that.
Well, thank you very much for coming today and sharing your story. It's very helpful.
No problem. Thank you guys for listening.
Thank you. Next, we have Jessica Whitney. Ms. Whitney, if you want to come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, my name is Jessica Whitney. I am a Deputy Attorney General with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office over Consumer Protection. I've been there about a year, but prior to being in the Minnesota AG's office, I spent 18 years down in Iowa, where I was the administrator of the Iowa Consumer Credit Code in addition to being head of the Consumer Protection Division. So I have a unique perspective to this bill because Iowa, as you heard, was the opt-out state for 43 years now at this point. And I'm here to tell you the sky's not falling, that this is the solution to close that loophole. In the AG's office, we are still seeing triple-digit interest rate complaints come through because of this fintech rent-a-bank world out there. They're not against Minnesota companies anymore. They're against fintechs and out-of-state lenders. But we're still seeing them, and our citizens are still subject to them. When I was down in Iowa, in fact, one of the last cases I did was an online fintech lender with a rent-a-bank that was charging 300-400% for things like pet loans and auto repair. And because Iowa had opted out of this interest rate exportation, I didn't even have to sue them. It was an out-of-court settlement once they got lawyers that understood what the opt-out did. In Iowa, it was a very bipartisan, supported by all state chartered institutions bill. It had been challenged about 3 years ago where the fintechs tried to get rid of it. It survived, again, in a very bipartisan manner. Iowa had and has a very robust lending system. I think the credit unions in Iowa, state credit unions, are about the same as the number we have in Minnesota, and Minnesota's double the size of Iowa. So this legislation, which puts Minnesota state banks and credit unions on an even playing field with their out-of-state counterparts, has only served in Iowa, and I've seen it firsthand, to bolster those charters, or at least it certainly hasn't hurt them in any negative way. And it has allowed the state of Iowa to protect its citizens. If you go online to the state, to many of these online lenders, you'll see Iowa is a no-go. If you're an Iowa citizen, you cannot borrow from them. I will also say some of these fintech lenders have gone ahead and got an Iowa regulated lending license, which subjects them to, again, the same limits as Iowa companies under that regulated lending license, and they could do something very similar here in Iowa. So with that, if you have questions later, I am happy to answer them.
Thank you very much. We'll now move to public testimony. We still have a packed agenda, so we've asked public testifiers to limit their comments to 2 minutes each. And I'm going to say who's speaking first, then who's coming up next, and if you could just move up so you can hop right up when it's your turn. So first we have Phil Goldfeder, who will be followed by Kent Kaiser. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Chairman Stevenson, Vice Chair sitting right next to me, and members of the House Committee on Commerce, Finance, and Policy for providing me the opportunity to testify before you in opposition to HF 3680. My name is Phil Goldfeder. I served as a senior advisor to Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. I'm a former state legislator from New York. I now continue in my public service as the CEO of an organization called the American FinTech Council based in Washington, D.C. As CEO of a standards-based trade association representing responsible fintech companies of all sizes, and their innovative partner banks, I recognize that not all bank fintech partnerships are created equal. And while AFC members do not offer loans above 36% interest rate, other bank fintech partnerships do not hold themselves to such a standard. In recognition of that, AFC agrees with the bill's intent of creating proper guardrails to ensure Minnesota consumers are protected from high-interest lenders operating outside of the state's regulatory perimeter. However, this bill is a blunt legislative tool when an issue like this requires a bit more nuance in understanding bank fintech partnerships. HF 3680 diminishes access for Minnesotans. Under the current law, state-chartered community banks are able to partner with fintech companies to offer much-needed, safe, and affordable credit to consumers. This bill opts Minnesota out of the federal law that enables community banks to compete with national banks. As a result, this will significantly decrease the supply of affordable credit in Minnesota at a time when, according to the CFPB, credit card interest rates are at an all-time high and being driven by a lack of competition. Consumers deserve options in financial services to choose the most appropriate financial products that best serve their needs in the moment. Further, high-cost lenders will seek loopholes, like partnering with nationally chartered banks who are not impacted by the bill's provisions, to continue offering the predatory products to consumers previously served by the responsible lenders that make up AFC's membership. To believe that demand for financial access will simply subside or that in-state banks will be able to fill the current gap served by the out-of-state banks is simply incorrect. What will happen is consumers once responsibly served through bank fintech partnerships will now either have no option for credit or be forced to engage with high-interest payday or predatory lenders. If passed, this bill will decrease access to responsible credit, put community banks at a disadvantage, and leave many Minnesota consumers, particularly those in minority and rural communities, with no options but to rely on far too many predatory and high-interest alternatives. Unfortunately, while the desire to pass this bill may fill the hearts and minds of consumer advocates, the unfortunate impact to Minnesotans will be felt immediately, and the true negative impact will last for years to come. It will be this House, not the advocates, who are going to have to spend time in years to come to solve the problems that are created by this bill. So, therefore, we respectfully request that the committee table the bill to consider the nuances needed to properly solve the issues discussed and not harm over hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans being responsibly served by the members of the American FinTech Council. And again, I thank you for the opportunity to present.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Kent Kaiser, who will be followed by Nicole Dogwell. Mr. Kaiser, come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing me to testify in opposition to House File 3680. I'm Dr. Kent Kaiser, Secretary Treasurer of the Domestic Policy Caucus. I live here in the North End. It's a unanimous 1978 U.S. Supreme Court decision governing federally chartered banks and the 1980 law signed by President Carter called DIDMCA that governs the state chartered banks that established the banks' right to charge the interest rates applicable to where the banks are based rather than where the consumers reside. And the result has been a vibrant competition among all banks, nationally and state chartered, to provide more and more attractive terms on credit and to provide more credit options, as well as to provide credit to more and more people across state lines. Millions of previously credit-deprived and underbanked consumers have been brought out of the margins and into the mainstream. Understand, 32% of consumers have non-prime credit scores. That's 1.8 million Minnesotans. 20% of Minnesotans have difficulty paying ordinary household expenses, and 17% have outstanding credit card debt that exceeds 75% of their total credit limit. These are among the consumers who would be harmed by House File 3680. At first, several states exercised DIDMCA's opt-out provision. Over time, only Iowa and Puerto Rico have kept it. Colorado hasn't opted out quite yet. And that was after realizing the harm to consumers that the rest gave up their opt-outs. Iowa operates in a pre-1980s market, putting Iowa consumers at a disadvantage. It also puts Iowa state banks at a disadvantage compared to the massive, impersonal national chartered banks. It is these, the largest banks in the nation, that are charging the highest fees, and they'd be exempt from House File 3680 because they would continue to be governed by the Supreme Court's 1978 decision. House File 3680 would harm the smaller, personable state-chartered banks offering individualized credit off solutions that we should want to be the solution for Minnesotans in need. Please don't abandon vulnerable Minnesotans in a 1960s-style credit desert resembling Iowa. Please oppose House File 3680. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kaiser. Our next testifier is Nicole Dogwell, who will be followed by Julia Donnelly. Ms. Dogwell, please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for having me today. My name is Nicole Dogwell. I am a local attorney based in Minneapolis. I'm a former general counsel of a lending company, and now I'm in private practice representing financial institutions. And I'm here today representing the Online Lenders Alliance. We've submitted a letter in detail, but I just wanted to kind of hone in on one concern that we have with this bill. Namely, the people that are taking out these type of loans are called, you know, underbanked or unbanked or credit constrained. In Minnesota, 10% of the population is underbanked or unbanked, and 28% of the population is considered credit constrained pursuant to FDIC data. The problem with this bill that we see is that if you restrict this kind of credit access to these people who need it the most, the consumers I think that many of you are trying to protect, where are they going to go? I think that the overall concept of this bill is just too obtuse and too blunt, because I think further study needs to be done to make sure that the consumers you're really trying to protect, these unbanked, these underbanked, these credit-constrained people, have access to credit, because if that credit is gone, where are they going to go? So I just think this bill needs further study. I think NERA has done a comprehensive study on this, on the impact of what would happen in Colorado. I would just ask this legislature to consider that. Look at all the consequences of what would happen with this act before you pass this on. Thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Next, we have Julia Donnelly, followed by Danielle Arlo. Ms. Donnelly, please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julia Donnelly. I'm with Almeida Public Affairs, located here in St. Paul, and I'm here today on behalf of Upstart. So Upstart is a network where about 100 banks, credit unions, CDFIs, and minority depository institutions compete for customers who are looking to borrow from regulated lenders online, quickly and safely. Whatever bank is offering the customer the lowest rate will get to offer that person the loan. That means that people in Minnesota can get loan offers, all of which are below 36% from across the country, not just local lenders. Upstart uses data and AI tools so that lenders qualify applicants with lower incomes and credit scores. These are people who usually would not get a bank offer of credit or would be stuck paying with payday loans or very high interest credit card rates. This could be younger borrowers, this could be renters, this could be people that don't own an asset like a vehicle. So a real life example of why we have concerns. So our typically consumers use the funds they borrow through Upstart to pay off higher interest rate credit card debt. Today, those rates are at an all-time high, as we know and this committee has discussed. The most typical hypothetical situation is a person has $8,000 of credit card debt and is not able to pay off their balance in full. So instead, they're paying these big national banks 30% APR. Generally, they'll come to Upstart and get a 23% APR rate, pay off that credit card debt, and then continue to make those installments over time. This will actually help, you know, ease that burden and also raise their credit scores. So under this proposal, people will be stuck with 30 to 36% credit card rate from a national bank, but will lose out on the opportunity for 23% refinance option. So only those that qualify for a loan under 21% will have access to this. Everyone else, which is about 50% of those who come to qualify or to come to Upstart to borrow, will be denied access. So we look forward to working with you and with Representative Katiza Watoon on alternatives and approaches, and we thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. The last testifier who signed up in advance is Danielle Arlo. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Danielle Fagri Arlo, Senior Vice President of the American Financial Services Association. We're based in D.C., but I live here and I have for almost my entire life. Our association is more than 100 years old. We represent the consumer credit industry, including vehicle finance, mortgage lending, traditional installment lending, and credit cards. Our members include everyone from people operating in one or two states to some of the world's largest banks. We do not represent payday lenders. We do not represent title lenders. We do not represent credit unions. I can't overstate how concerned we are about HF 3680. Our members are using state chartered banks to do something very different than anything that's been talked about today. For example, a very large credit company that probably everyone in this room thinks is a national bank is actually a state chartered bank organized after DIDMACA became law in 1980. Another one of our members that looks just like a captive vehicle finance company is actually a state chartered bank making direct loans all across the country. We have another member that is a captive vehicle finance company that has a state chartered bank as part of its business model. And they use it as a liquidity option and a financing option, extending credit to automobile dealers to finance the cars in their showrooms and on their lots, or funding customer vehicle purchases all across the country for different brands of vehicles that are not their own. A state charter offers a bank certainty, predictability, and consistency. DIDMACA was intended to put state charter banks on par with national banks, and that's what it did. State opt-outs of DIDMACA present an existential threat to those members that I just mentioned. After DIDMACA was passed, 7 states opted out, as we just heard. Until last year, no state had opted out for 40 years. Every single state since 1983, when the last state opted out, has reversed course, except Iowa. And the question is why, and we don't know the answer. But were they protecting their citizens too much? Or did it turn out that DIDMACA opt-out hurt their state's banks more than it helped their consumers? And you don't have to believe me. Ask any outside counsel in this country who deals with these matters if they are currently recommending would-be banks to seek a state charter or a national charter. The answer is no, not a state charter. Just one state opting out after 40 years since the last state opted out, a law that is not even in effect until July 1st of this year, has destabilized the market so much that recommending seeking a state charter is too risky. Happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion and questions. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. One, I'm trying to, clearly the language is difficult to understand. There's a lot to unpack here just because it is regarding this 1980 law by the feds. So my question is, in my understanding, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I just want to understand this. Does this exempt credit card companies?
Representative Katisa Bouchon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative New Brindley, yes.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that is what I understood, but I couldn't find it exactly in the language, so I wasn't sure. I'm a little concerned about it exempting credit card companies. I'm not sure why it would do that, particularly given, I think it was Ms. Donnelly testified about credit card companies, and often those are high interest rates. And we know, particularly post-pandemic with the inflation, credit card debt is up across the country significantly. And that means a lot of people are paying much higher interest rates, and this is potentially removing an option for them to manage that debt. My other question, I was trying to understand this. I don't remember who testified, but somebody said that access to credit had not suffered, but it looked like, I mean, Colorado did this study on from the Financial Health Network on the effects of this, and they found that access to credit did suffer, and that in Iowa it was even worse. And so I'm wondering, does somebody have actual data on that, as opposed to just somebody telling me that it's the same?
Representative Katisa Bouchon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if the Deputy Attorney General might be able to come and assist with that, given her experience in Iowa.
Ms. Whitney, I don't know if you have a comment on that.
I do. I don't think the Colorado study was that black and white. And we can get that for you. Again, I was there 18 years. We weren't suffering. There was no credit desert in Iowa. It's easy enough in Iowa to get credit. In fact, like I said, it created this robust system of state credit unions and banks. And Colorado was trying to do what it could with its limited data. But again, we didn't see Iowans suffering, and certainly triple-digit interest rate doesn't help them in the long run anyway. It's like a concrete life preserver where it sinks them and grounds them in further debt. But we can take a closer look at that Colorado study, and happy to parse it through with you.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I appreciate that. I think it's important just because, I mean, Colorado passed this. They want to implement it. And so I suspect that they weren't real happy with the results of the study.
because they want this to happen. And so I think that this access to credit really is a concern. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, this example of a 200% interest rate is absurd, right? Like, no one in this room thinks that there is anything conscionable or moral about that. But there seems to be a big difference between that and what this bill is doing. And so my concern is, you know, I mean, the question I asked immediately is, I mean, frankly, reliable transportation is a huge barrier to folks working their way out of poverty. And are we removing potential access to folks being able to do that? I mean, I think I'm particularly concerned as a border state, and particularly representing a border community, what happens when somebody has a major car repair? Is there option now to scoot over to Hudson, 20 minutes away, this is not far, and get a title loan where they're actually using their title now as collateral and they're gonna lose their vehicle, whereas maybe, even though a bank won't give them traditional credit, they won't give them a traditional loan, maybe they could get a loan for 30%, or somebody would be willing to take that risk. I understand the intention, and like I said, I mean, 200%, like, this stuff is unconscionable. Like, I don't think anybody disagrees, but I worry that there are pretty significant unintended consequences of this for folks who don't have other options. And I get, I mean, Exodus Lending, I love what they're doing. I think it's absolutely brilliant, but they're not helping everybody and they can't help everybody. And they're one organization and we're taking this tool out of the toolbox. And I think there are real examples of how this is gonna hurt people. So while I understand the intention, I like the intention, it just seems like there has to be a rifle approach instead of a shotgun approach that is probably going to hurt some folks as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Katisa Witoon, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the conversation today. I think, you know, it's important to consider the organizations who are supporting this, including the Minnesota Credit Unions. And I think that when we on the whole, want to ensure that we're protecting Minnesota's borrowers and supporting businesses that are based here in Minnesota. So that equal playing field, I think, is a really important part of this. And it's going to end the flow of our citizens' dollars into the pockets of predatory lenders that are out of state. So that money is leaving Minnesota, and I think that it's important that we protect borrowers. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Katisa Witoon renews her motion that House File 3680 as amended be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and House File 3680 as amended is recommended be placed on the general register. The next item on our agenda is House File 4085 from Representative Tabke. Representative Tabke, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move House File 4085 to the General Register.
Representative Tabke moves House File 4085 be placed on the General Register. Representative Tabke, to your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This is a department bill that is taking care of some obsolete language that has not been used or enforced in over 15 years. So what this bill does is it works with the oxygenate and fuels. And so basically when you go to the gas station, you have an 87 octane fuel, and you have maybe a 91 octane fuel. They have those two pumps, those two tanks in the ground, and they blend that fuel to give you an 89. So if you're going to get the middle range of the fuel when you're purchasing it, it also works with biofuels as well, with ethanol and other things. And so that is that actual blending of the fuel is illegal in Minnesota, and it hasn't been enforced and done for a long time. So this is cleaning up obsolete language to give regulatory certainty to gas station owners. And Mr. Chair, it's a pretty simple bill with that repealer in it, and we have Mr. Kelly here if there are any questions, but we can move forward with whatever you'd like.
All right, Mr. Kelly, do you have remarks?
Given the time, Chair, for the record, John Kelly, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. Given the time, unless there are questions, I don't need to repeat what Representative Tappy said.
Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, member discussion to the bill. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Representative Tappy. So just why was it there initially, originally?
Mr. Kelly.
Chair, Representative, so this was passed in the 1990s as, you know, there were oxygenates being added into fuels. And there was, and so we believe that, I mean, no one from the department was here at that point, but we believe that this was on there to ensure that the refineries that were having the fuel were getting their equipment up there so they could start to blend the fuels, and it was in a controlled manner. But the way that the market has gone, most stations blend their fuels in a blender pump now, and so it's obsolete, but they are technically breaking the law. And there were some revisions to this statute in the mid-1990s, and they took out a number of sections, and we believe we can't prove that this is something that should have come out but didn't.
Closing comments, Representative Tabke.
I have none. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Tabke renews his motion that House File 4085 be placed in the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 4085 is recommended to be placed in the General Register. The last item on our agenda today is House File 3981 from Representative Novotny. While Representative Novotny is coming forward, I will move that House File 3981 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Novotny, when you are settled, you may proceed to describe your bill.
Thank you, Chair. I was approached this summer by a constituent who was pointing out an old statute on the consumer protection bill that requires, if requested, a written estimate when doing work for repairs on homes, appliances, materials, things like that, that if the bill is going to exceed more than 10%, that the shop performing that work would have to get prior authorization before going forward with that work if it exceeded the written estimate. The last time this bill was updated was 1996, and just to put things in perspective, the average used car in 1996 had a value of $8,257, with a new value for a vehicle in 1986 as $18,777. If we go by 2024 numbers, the average used car is up to $25,000, and a new car is over $48,000. We did contact Commerce Department, and there was some confusion over if the bill exceeded $7,500, if that limit was still in place, and there was confusion. I did contact House Research, and they confirmed our belief that as written, the 90 and last updated in 1996, that if the shop estimate is originally over $7,500, that the limitation for a 10% overage would not apply. They did not. House Research was unable to find any comments while listening to the archives on why they put that limit of $7,500 in there. And it's been upstated twice since it originally came in 1979. So my thought was that instead of going back every 20 to 30 years and adjusting the upper amount, which I never understood anyway, that we would just leave the 10% overage as protection, and it seems like a pretty simple fix. That is my bill, Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative Motney. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Scott Lambert, President of the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association. And, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee really don't have a problem at all with the bill, and especially with removing the upper cap. But for as long as this law has been around, and it's kind of a dumb small thing, I'm sorry to bother you with it, we've always felt that the quotation mark is in the wrong spot because we have to hang a sign in our businesses. And at the very end of Section 2, the quotation mark is at the end of the paragraph, and really it ought to be at the end of the sentence before that. So if the author would indulge a small amendment, whenever this comes up, it makes for an awkward signage in our facilities. And since the statute is now in front of the committee, we thought maybe we could fix this small problem. It's never worth its own bill, really. If it hadn't come up, we wouldn't be bothering you with it.
Mr. Chair, could we repeat that citing again? Now that everybody's got their paperwork on.
In Section 2, Mr. Chairman, in Section 2, the quotation mark is at the end of the paragraph after the word assessments. And we really think it ought to be at the end of the word limitations at the end of the previous sentence.
On line 1.18. Mm-hmm. That sure seems right to me. Yeah. I will editorialize that I agree with your assessment. The bill's being laid over today, and so we can definitely consider making that grammatical change when and if the bill reappears.
But thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Mr. Lambert. Seeing no other members of the public stepping forward to testify discussion to the bill, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to say, Mr. Lambert, thank you for noticing things like a quotation mark. I live for this stuff around here. I just want to say, I mean, frankly, the cap, the $7,500 seems really odd. I mean, my husband, I own a residential remodeling company. This is what we do. And there would never be a circumstance where a bid would change and the cost would increase that much, and we would not work through that with a customer ahead of time, or frankly, we would eat it. Like, we would never do that. I mean, this is just good business practice.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Novotny, I don't know if your bill allows this or if the current law allows this, but oftentimes when I need to have some repairs done on my vehicle, it's a crisis situation, and I'm the one who defines crisis. So I'm like, it's Monday morning, I got to go to the cities to get to the session or whatever the case may be, or I'm back on a Thursday for a Friday. So I call up my good friends who I've done business with for 25 years, and I go, can I get it in? They go, yep, we can get you in. And I oftentimes say, if it's $300 or less, let's just do it. Call me when it's done. Can I still have that right to be able to talk to my repair place, or do we have to stop, have them send me an estimate, and I have to get back to them with everything else that's going on, and potentially delay the ability of my vehicle to get repaired when I need it?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question, Representative Driscoll, and thank you for asking that. As I will refer you back to the language, the written estimate is only right now in place. The requirements of this bill only kick in if you, as a customer, request the written estimate beforehand. If you do a verbal argument because it's a shop that you trust, that would not be affected by this bill and before or after.
Representative Cleavorn.
No questions, please.
Closing comments, Representative Novotny.
It's a good bill. I can't see a reason not to oppose it, and I welcome the language. I thought it would be a good way to fix this anyway, with the language, if they're going to reprint it, and now it makes it even more sensical. Thank you.
It is a good bill. Thank you for bringing it. And with that, Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, I don't know if we formally adopted the amendment, or if you need to.
We
but
didn't
I just
because
wanted...
we're laying the bill over. Okay. So we didn't make or adopt an amendment as to the quotation mark. If and when the bill comes back, we'll either on its own or in an omnibus, we will probably incorporate the quotation mark, assuming it's agreeable to Representative Otney. But great. With that, the bill's laid over. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.